Thank you very much, Peter. Just like to thank Peter for inviting me here. I was actually invited last year and was unable to attend. To my own great loss, this looks like a great forum to talk about issues related to liberty. I see a friendly face in the back there, and Jim McIntosh, who has given me the opportunity to speak at Libertarian Party functions as well, which I'm very appreciative for. I've titled my talk, Liberty, the Solution to Our Healthcare Woes. And obviously talking about liberty is appropriate for a forum like this, but I think it's doubly appropriate given the recent Supreme Court ruling in the Chiuli case, because I think that ruling, and I'm no lawyer, and I'll give deference to the lawyers who are on the panel before me, but I think that ruling and its two fundamental findings was really addressing questions of liberty, not going as far as someone who admittedly would be a libertarian himself. I would like to have seen them gone further in addressing questions of liberty, and I'll get into some of that. But nonetheless, it provides a context in which to talk about healthcare around the topic of liberty. And I think, judge from the discussion that happened before I took the podium, that there's probably a good degree of knowledge about what exactly occurred in those cases, in that case. But I'd like to kind of go through it a little bit in detail. As you know, the main appellants were Dr. Jacques Chiuli and George Zeliotis. The basis of the case was that Mr. Zeliotis, being a patient, experienced long waiting times for access to medical services. And this prompted him to start speaking out about waiting times in the Quebec public health care system. And on the other side of this, Dr. Chiuli was a physician who wanted to be able to provide health care services outside the public monopoly in order to facilitate quicker access for Mr. Zeliotis and others like him. Now, the appellants contested the validity of the prohibition on private health insurance in Quebec's Health Insurance and Hospital Insurance Acts, and they contended that the prohibition against private payment for private services essentially deprived them of access to necessary health care, and it was related to the measurement of long wait times, or the observation that there were long wait times in the system. And this was a function of the system itself, and this was their argument. Now, they claimed their rights under Section 7 of the Canadian Charter and under Section 1 of the Quebec Charter, which essentially use similar language about life, liberty, and security of person, or something close to that. And I think it's interesting to note that that language is important, because in its findings, I think the court addressed part of life, liberty, and security of the person, but not all of that phrase. And what eventually resulted, of course, is the Quebec Superior Court had dismissed earlier rulings. The Federal Court of Appeal had affirmed that decision, and the case was eventually appealed to the Supreme Court of Canada. In the Chiuli versus Quebec case before the Supreme Court, 7 judges presided. It's important to note that 4 ruled in favor of Dr. Chiuli and Mr. Zeliotis, and 3 dissented. It is also interesting to note that 3 of the majority judges addressed both the Charter of Rights for Canada and the Quebec Charter of Rights. But the 4th majority judge was silent on the charter implications. So at this moment, what that means is that the ruling applies only to Quebec, because the majority only agreed that Quebec's Medicare monopoly violated the provincial Charter of Rights and could not be saved or justified by other provisions of the Charter, as lower courts had previously ruled. The lower courts had essentially said that other social policy goals justified limitations on rights. And the Supreme Court argued that the way the Quebec Charter was worded allowed them to overturn lower court rulings and affirm the appeal of Dr. Chiuli and Mr. Zeliotis. Now, there are 2 key findings are important, and I have broken them up in that way into 2 sections. And according to the comments of the lead justice, and I will quote here, the evidence shows that in the case of certain surgical procedures, the delays that are the necessary result of waiting lists increase the patient's risk of mortality or the risk that his or her injuries will become irreparable. The evidence also shows that many patients on non-urgent waiting lists are in pain and cannot fully enjoy any real quality of life. The right to life and to personal inviolability, that's the language of the Quebec Act, is therefore affected by the waiting times. So the translation is, we have a fundamental, inviolable right to preserve and improve our own life and health. but it is important to note that the Quebec or the Supreme Court ruling did not address an individual's right to simple choice, to a simple libertarian choice of whether to receive services from a public monopoly or whether to receive them from the private sector. So the court is arguing essentially that because of the public monopolies, tendency to produce waiting times for access to services, that essentially is the reason why rights are violated under Section 1 of the Quebec Charter. Now, three of the judges also believe that Section 7 of the Canadian Charter was violated as well. Now, secondly, the court ruled, and I quote, the infringement of rights protected by Section 1 is not justified under other sections of the Quebec Charter. It cannot be concluded from the evidence concerning the Quebec plan, or the plans of the other provinces of Canada, or from the evolution of the systems of various OECD countries, that an absolute prohibition on private insurance is necessary to protect the integrity of the public plan. There are a wide range of measures that are less drastic and also less intrusive in relation to these protected rights. So the translation here is simply, public monopoly is not necessary to ensure the basic social goals of Medicare, which are universal access to medically necessary care. And it really confirms the viability of the arguments in favor of a minimal role for the state when it comes to Medicare. So in summary, the courts did recognize that Canadian Medicare violates liberty, at least in terms of it violates liberty in the sense as long as it affects life and security of person. The courts also agreed that expanding liberty, allowing a parallel private system, would not undermine the social goal of guaranteeing access to medically necessary care. Now, I'd like to take the argument a little bit further than what the courts have argued and simply say that we have a basic right, a basic individual right to choice, regardless of whether the public monopoly can meet our needs to for access to medically necessary care. If we choose to pay privately for those services, we have a fundamental right to do so. Now, the court has not recognized that. That would be the first thing I'd want to say. The second thing I'd want to say is that not only does greater liberty in healthcare not threaten the basic social goals, achieving the basic social goals for Medicare, but expanding liberty in healthcare choices will actually make the healthcare system better for everyone. It's not a simple matter of not undermining the goals the government has for universal access to healthcare. It's really about making the healthcare system for better for everyone, not just people who access private care, but also for those who continue to rely on the public system. And I will finally argue that opponents of expanding liberty in healthcare are really not concerned with protecting the viability of the public system to begin with. What they're really concerned with is ensuring or imposing egalitarian socialism in healthcare. What they're really interested in is egalitarian access, and I'll get into some of the implications of that as we go through. Now, I think it would be important to sort of define what I mean by liberty in healthcare choices or liberty in healthcare, and I think that there's three ways to do that. The first way would be to talk about liberty in terms of patient choice. This would involve simply the option to exit the public monopoly, the option to pay privately for healthcare services if one desires to do so. And there also it would also involve eliminating or reducing the regulatory barriers to people accessing private health care as well. So not just limiting the prohibition against doing so, but any regulatory or legal barriers to doing so. I think a second way to talk about liberty, which people often forget to mention, is patient responsibility. Clearly, any concept of liberty means that we would apply that not just to ourselves, but also to our neighbors. And so that while we would want to be free to access the services we need medically, we wouldn't want to obligate our neighbor to pay for that. So there's an element of patient responsibility that goes along with liberty, which is simply being responsible for the healthcare services that one consumes. It's the user pay principle. I think thirdly, to define liberty in healthcare, I think one would have to talk about economic rights. So not just the liberty of patients per se to access the care they need, to exercise choices and to be responsible for the healthcare they consume, but also economic rights and freedoms for providers of health care, so that providers can choose where and when under what terms they would like to provide health care services or health care goods for patients. And so this would involve things like protection of property and contract and a recognition of the legitimacy of free market competition and the pursuit of profit in health care, something that really Canadians are loath to accept. And so that's how I think it would be proper or appropriate to define liberty for the purposes of my talk. Now, what I'd like to do, and I think it's the heart of what we do at the Fraser Institute, which is fulfill our mandate. We have a motto at the Institute, which is, if it matters, measure it. And so in fulfilling this mandate, what I'd like to do is sort of identify some of the problems that exist in the Canadian healthcare system and explain their nature, and sort of get into a discussion about how expanding choice and responsibility and economic rights and freedoms can fix these sorts of problems. So, I mean, I'm sure most of you are familiar with the majority of the high-profile examples of what's wrong with our system, and I'm going to keep it simple by simply reviewing some of these things. First of all, Medicare fails to optimize the value for money that taxpayers should receive for their tax dollars spent on healthcare. If we were to look at Canadian total health spending, this would involve both public and private, we would find that relative to other countries in the OECD, similar countries of economic development, countries like France and Sweden, the UK, for instance, we would find that Canada finishes third in terms of its overall level of age-adjusted spending. What I mean by age-adjusted spending is that when you have a society that is generally older, you would expect to find a greater propensity to spend on healthcare because healthcare spending tends to be correlated with age. About 50% of lifetime expenditures on healthcare occur after the age of 65. So what this means is that we have to adjust for the age of a population when comparing across countries. And when we do that, Canada finishes third relative to all other OECD countries, except with the exclusion of the United States. Our research excludes the United States because it's strictly a strategic reason, which is simply to eliminate arguments that we're promoting an American-style healthcare system by making these kinds of comparisons. The United States, if ranked against Canada, would finish higher, and we would be fourth if compared, including the United States. Still, what does that mean? It doesn't necessarily mean we spend too much. It doesn't mean we spend too little. We have to talk about these things in terms of value for money. So Canada spending third among comparable OECD countries. What do we get in return? Well, we can look at the heart of the Chiuli case, which was waste for medical care. And, you know, Chiuli's case was very solid. Our research shows that in 1993, on average, over 12 specialties in 10 provinces, the average wait from a consultation with your family doctor to actually receiving specialist treatment was 9.3 weeks. In 2004, that wait nearly doubled to 17.9 weeks. So from just over 9 weeks to just about 18 weeks, that is how much waiting times have increased over that period of time. So the problem is getting worse, it's not getting better, it's not even stable. Importantly, what does this mean? Say we wait longer, what does that mean? Does that mean healthcare is deteriorating? Yes, it does. These actual waits for treatment average almost double what doctors say is medically reasonable. So we're waiting twice as long as what our doctors tell us is medically reasonable, averaging across all of the cases that we research. Secondly, there's a lack of resources produced in the Canadian medical system. Canada places 24th out of 27 OECD countries in terms of the number of physicians we have servicing our population. And this is done on a physician-to-population ratio, which makes it comparable across countries. So we're 24, first being best, 27th being worst. In terms of access to high-technology diagnostic devices, ones that we're all familiar with, like MRI machines, Canada is 13th of the 22 OECD countries for which there is data available. Again, number one being best, number 22 being worst, 13th somewhere close to the middle area. Mediocre at best in terms of access to diagnostic machines. Other diagnostic devices, cutting-edge technology like PET scanners, are virtually unavailable or non-existent in Canada. Now, it's also interesting to note, in terms of the lack of resources, the deterioration in our healthcare infrastructure that is occurring. The Ontario Hospital Association has put out data, for instance, which compares the average age of an Ontario hospital to the average age of an American hospital. Here's the comparison. The average age of an Ontario hospital is 40 years. The average age of a U.S. hospital, by comparison, 9 years. So what we have is a system that is essentially nationalized the infrastructure of our healthcare system and has never paid the capital upkeep of that system. And so that is in a serious deficit situation. The Ontario Hospital Association annually reports about its capital deficit situation, in addition to its operating deficits, by the way, which are guaranteed by public budgets. We also wait for other things other than the services of physicians and hospitals. We wait for access to new medicines. In fact, Canadians wait longer than the U.S., Sweden, the United Kingdom, and Australia. In fact, our wait for access to new medicines is double the wait in the United States. So when a new medicine is developed and it's ready to go to market, the Canadian government holds it up twice as long as the American government holds it up. Now, there's reasons for that. I've done some recent research that indicates that's a cost control mechanism. They simply don't want you to have access to it because then they have to pay for it publicly. And I'll get into some reasons why they don't want to pay for it publicly. Canada also approves fewer new drugs in the countries I mentioned. What this means is that we don't have access to some drugs at all. It's not a delay. You just won't get access to some drugs. They're just not ever going to be approved. This has significant implications for certain patient populations. If we were talking about pain medicine, perhaps one would argue it's not that important that that drug is delayed in terms of its public coverage. We wouldn't argue, for instance, if we couldn't get access to aspirin or something like that. But if it's a life-saving drug we're talking about a serious issue, especially if people have been prohibited from buying private insurance or if because of their tax levels and so on, they don't simply have the economic option to purchase private insurance for these things. Let's look at the Herceptin case. Herceptin is a cancer drug. It's for breast cancer patients, and essentially the drug has been shown to reduce by 50% the recurrence of breast cancer. It sends it all into remission, essentially, in 50% of the cases. So it's a life-saving drug for the population of breast cancer patients. It's a life-saving drug in 50 out of 100 cases. Now, the drug cost is quite significant. It's $35,000 plus per person annually. Clearly something beyond the means of us to pay out of pocket. And it's something that is a perfect case for insurance, public or private. Now, that's an extraordinary cost per person. But the total social cost of funding that drug is $55 million annually in Ontario. That's only about 1.6% of total public spending on drugs in the province of Ontario. So clearly, governments have the means to pay for it publicly based on these relative measures. The problem is that public health care budgets have grown enormously and are growing, in fact, out of control, beyond the ability of taxpayers to continue to fund it. And so governments can't continue to fund these new drugs that come up because it will break the bank. It will send the programs into bankruptcy. Now, why is that? It's simply because of the universal design of these programs. We pay for a large number of affordable drugs for large populations, mostly seniors and welfare recipients, but drugs that are mostly affordable. And what that means is that we don't have any money left over to pay for these truly catastrophic medicines. So there's a real, the Canadian system is failing people on a real level in terms of the impact on not just their health, but potentially on their life. And I mentioned the universal aspect of our drug programs. It's interesting to know Roy Romanow's commission did some work on this. They took statistics from Manitoba, and you could extrapolate these across the country, I think, fairly confidently. And they showed that only 3% of the population spends more than the definition of a catastrophic threshold that the committee came up with, which was $1,500 per person annually. So only 3% spends more than that. In fact, only 3% of households in Canada spend more than 5% of their income. So this is clearly a sustainable population. It's a small part of the population. They spend really 44% of all spending on drugs, which means, of course, by the committee's own admission, 56% of all drug expenditures currently are unnecessary. This is producing this perverse result where we pay for these drugs that are affordable for a lot of people, but we won't pay for the drugs that are life-saving drugs through our public programs. Not to mention the potential savings that could accrue to taxpayers if we were to go with a less universal approach. So Medicare fails to provide optimal value for money relative to other countries, relative to its own internal measurements of its performance on waits for medical care, lack of resources, waits for access to new drugs. This is caused by overutilization related to the full insurance design of our programs. That is, every penny of medical services is paid for from the first dollar. There are no deductibles as there are with your auto insurance, where you might pay, say, the first $500 of auto insurance costs. And there's no copayment on a percentage basis, where you, say, pay 10% of your medical expenditures out of pocket. And so these are the kinds of things that are a violation of normal economics and insurance. They're built into our programs, and it's causing all of these problems. Really, what it amounts to is a lack of user pay responsibility, which is one of the principles of liberty. People should be responsible for themselves. The lack of value for money efficiency is also related to the fact that there is no hard budget applied to things like hospitals. The hospital overruns its budget. Generally, the public picks up the tab. As long as you want those hospitals to remain public and not charge market prices, that's the way it has to work. So again, the lack of a market in our healthcare system, lack of economic freedom or liberty, is leading to these problems. Again, This is because of political consideration to maintain a public monopoly and to violate individual liberty and economic liberty in healthcare. Now, on some other points related to the financing of Medicare, just not that our overall costs are not providing value for money, but even if we could argue that we were getting value for money, in terms of the money we spend on healthcare, we're actually getting what we pay for. We spend a lot, but we get a lot. That argument might be valid to a lot of people, but the fact is that it's not even financially sustainable, even now. It would be much less financially sustainable if we did get in return what we paid for. In other words, we decided to pay more to get more. And that's because of a number of inefficiencies, but let me look again at a number of measures. The Institute has measured, for instance, public health expenditures, not total health spending, but just the money spent by provinces on healthcare. And we've done that in comparison to total revenues in the provinces from all sources. So not just from taxes, but also from profits from crown corporations and from government transfers from the federal government for healthcare. And or for anything else for that matter. We're looking at the total revenue package to each province, its total ability to pay for health care, the growth in that revenue figure compared to the growth in public health expenditures. And the fact is that for a very, very long time, public health spending has been growing at a faster rate than the total revenue resources that the province has available to it. In every province in Canada, all 10 provinces, Ontario being the worst case. What this means, of course, is that the long-term trend is showing that public health expenditures are swallowing a larger and larger percentage of total revenues spent in the province, or total revenues collected in the province. Now, anybody who understands finance will quickly recognize that's a recipe for bankruptcy. Eventually, public health spending will take up 100% of all revenues at this pace. It's a theoretical possibility. It's a political improbability, I would say. But nonetheless, that's the policy logic of healthcare in Canada. And in fact, as I mentioned, Ontario is the worst case scenario. And in 6 years, Ontario's revenues, 50% of Ontario's revenues will be spent on healthcare in 6 years. And in fact, by the year 2013, about 60% will be spent on public health in the province. And eventually, by the year mid-year 2032 or so, about 100% of all revenues will be spent on healthcare in the province of Ontario, theoretically at this pace. And this is a long-term trend. This is the most recent 5-year trend, which is the same as the 8-year trend, which is the same as the 30-year trend. And it's the same across the country to varying degrees. Some provinces have, in recent times, raised taxes in order to get revenues growing at a pace that will match public health spending. But there's a theoretical problem with that as well. Eventually, if taxes continue to rise as a percentage of our income every year, eventually taxes will swallow 100% of our income. And so the problem is on the health spending side. It's on the growth of health spending, and the problem is not on the growth of revenue side. Thirdly, we've talked about the problems in terms of value for money in our system, the fact that it's financially unsustainable, even under current circumstances where governments ration access to health care and ration access to medicines. But other aspects of our health policy prove to be a failure as well. And these are things like drug prices, for instance. The government, as you know, regulates drug prices. We have price controls at the federal level. We have forms of price control at provincial levels as well. We have rationing of access to drugs at the provincial level. What we end up finding with our government policy is that our branded drug prices, in fact, the ones that are controlled federally, are 43% below U.S. prices, which is the comparison we often make in order to have a benchmark for prices. But we find, in fact, that our generic prices, our prices for those drugs that are copies of patented or branded drugs, are 78% higher than they are in the United States. And there's reasons for that. The United States generic market is far more competitive than our market is. There's a large number of companies selling products in competition with each other. And there is competition from foreign producers as well. In Canada, we have all of these sorts of barriers to competition to foreign entry on the generic side, not on the branded side, but on the generic side. And so there's a policy of government favoritism. You know, we're all aware, for instance, that Americans will use the internet and cross the border to buy patented drugs in Canada that are under price control, and they're cheaper here because of that, and one reason is because of that. And so there's a savings for consumers that drives that trade. And our government allows that to occur, even though it will eventually threaten our drug supply in Canada. But on the other side of the equation, where Canadians could achieve savings by buying cheaper drugs in the United States on the generic side, buying these generic copy drugs, our government actually prohibits you from doing so. You cannot buy them via the internet, and you cannot bring them across the border. Customs will seize those items from you. So it's a double standard. It really amounts to trade protectionism. And there are other forms of government intervention in the market that lead to this enormous price inflation on the generic side. Well, what does it matter? It matters because the lost consumer and taxpayer savings from this price difference amounts to about $2 to $5 billion annually. And that's the estimate we provided in the research we had produced at the Institute. So there's this irony that our government gets involved in the market for healthcare, the market for drugs, and attempts to produce what it would say better outcomes, and in fact it's producing worse outcomes. So financial unsustainability in the system, that's leading to the rationing of medical goods, and there's and that financial unsustainability in turn leads to a lack of consumer freedom, which denies people access to medical treatment, which is the very definition of rationing. There's central planning in the system, which is an intrusion in economic freedom. It leads to a lack of efficient allocation. We have a lack of profit incentive and competition because of the lack of economic freedom. This leads to underinvestment and upgrading in our medical infrastructure. The public monopoly leads to the exploitation of medical labor. Our physicians, for instance, have not seen a price increase in real terms adjusted after inflation since 1970. A physician today, if you adjust their income on the basis of inflation, does not make any more than they made in the early 70s. That's significant because it contributes to a medical brain drain in the country, which contributes to human resource shortages. In fact, doctors could go to the States today and double, in some cases, triple their incomes. And so if we use the U.S. price as sort of a market price, a standard by which to judge the exploitation of medical labor in Canada, we can see there's a significant price being paid by our health professionals for being employees, essentially, of a public monopoly. So ironically, public monopoly exploits labor, to use Marx's language, I guess. And of course, there's regulatory delays and interference that limit consumer choice and distort the supply side of the market in terms of drug manufacturers, what they're willing to provide to our market, how much they're willing to invest in our market, people who produce medical technologies, what they're willing to do in the way of supplying our market. All of these things are distorted by these government interferences in liberty. Economic liberty, personal liberty, and overall liberty in healthcare. Now, I think the argument that came out of the Chiuli case from people who were intervening in opposition to Dr. Chiuli was that allowing a parallel private option would undermine the viability of the public system. And The court, of course, ruled that, you know, the international evidence shows that lots of countries have parallel private systems and their public systems are still very viable and healthy and successful. But I don't think that the argument that has been made against the parallel private option in healthcare is really based on an interest in ensuring the viability of the public system. Instead, what I think it's based on is essentially wanting egalitarian access to healthcare. I mean, all of the evidence is clear. The Institute has been measuring this now for 4 to 5 years and looking at the international evidence as the court has done and found that countries even like Sweden, bastions of socialist thought, are moving toward market solutions in healthcare, allowing private for-profit delivery of healthcare in their major cities. They're allowing parallel private options for individuals to purchase health insurance. They've introduced a price for medical services into their public system in the form of a user fee. And so all of these countries are doing the kinds of things that we at the Fraser Institute, I'm sure many of you have been recommending, which is to simply allow people the option to exit the public monopoly. But I think the resistance to that comes not from a belief, a genuine belief at least, that would undermine the public system, but simply that would undermine egalitarian access to the system. Now, I think that it is true. Expanding liberty in healthcare will undermine egalitarian access to the system. But what does that mean? What does that mean when moving from the status quo? Will people who rely on the public system receive better or worse care than they currently receive if we allow a parallel private option? Those people who exit the public monopoly, will they receive better or worse care than they currently receive under the system that we have now? The simple fact of the matter is that there will be different sorts of gains depending on your income level, your willingness to pay for private insurance, your willingness to pay out of pocket for private services. There will be different levels of gains that people will make. The people who can afford the gold-plated private insurance plans will probably get private room coverage and very low doctor and nurse patient ratios. They will get the best of care that we could imagine, the best of what can be produced in a free society. And those people who remain in a public monopoly will also benefit. They will receive quicker access to the services that they need because many people will have exited the public monopoly. They will leave the lineup or the queue. That will free up space. There will be proportionally, one would think, more public resources available to spend in the public system as well. And so while some may gain more than others, the point is that from the status quo, there will be absolute gains for everybody if we allow these kinds of changes. And these are the kinds of things we actually observe in societies that allow more liberty in healthcare. We see that there are virtually no waiting times in many of the systems we compare to. All of those systems have better value for money in terms of what they produce relative to the money they spend and what they receive in terms of physicians to population or what they receive in terms of access to high technology, more modern facilities, etc. And so really liberty in healthcare is not just about saying, well, it won't undermine the public system. It's really about saying it will improve the public system and it will improve access to care for those people who exit the public system. So liberty, in effect, is the solution to our healthcare woes. And so, as I've said, these absolute gains that we can achieve from moving away from the status quo and from adopting or expanding greater liberty in healthcare are something that we should be promoting. As they say, a rising tide lifts all ships, and this is better than what the defenders of the status quo are offering. Essentially what they're offering is that we can all be equal in healthcare as long as that means we all wait equally long, we are all equally miserable. And I would say that it's better to support expanding liberty in healthcare because, as in all other areas of life, a freedom is better than the alternative. And that is the sum of my comments today.
Just take a few few minutes to do some questions, but I just wanted to make a little note, which I was thinking about. The previous lecture on our discussion on media was talking about how you need to go into niche areas and find something that other people aren't talking about. And then, of course, Brett was just talking about the Shuli case. I thought it was interesting that we should point out that last summer, Peter broke the story of Shuli at the Western Standard, which was a very, very cool thing for him to do, given that he's a young guy, young writer. And so there's an example right there of someone who did a niche thing about in media. Anyway, and aside. So let's do question and answer. Anything about public health care, private health care?
One of the things you talked about is that Fraser, if you can measure it, you can...
If it matters, measure it.
If it matters, if it measures...
Matters. Say it 10 times fast. Yeah.
One thing I'm curious about or would be interesting is what's the average per capita expense for healthcare? Because the problem is we pay the money in taxes, but we never really see, we never get a bill saying, you know, you have paid $5,000 a year. Do you have any idea what the number is?
Well, the per capita expenditure, I think, is somewhere around $4,000 or approaching $4,000. But let me talk a little bit about whether that actually means anything. We want to be able to talk, first of all, in terms of return for the expenditure, right? If we spent $4,000 and we got only $1,500 worth of medical services and goods because the system is so inefficient, we would not consider that to be a good thing that we spent $4,000, even though it might be less than the $6,000 they spend per person in the United States, for instance. And I think really we have to consider the distribution of illness in the population, the way that insurance, if it was a market, the system of insurance would work. And that is, the per capita is essentially an average expenditure. And it means very little because most people would spend less than that average, and very few people would spend a great deal more. I had the opportunity to look at Nova Scotia's access to physician services, for instance, as a proxy for access to all healthcare services. And what I found was that 20% of the population of Nova Scotia, and I had data on everyone in the province, nearly 1 million records over 7 years, and 20% of the population in any given year never saw a doctor even a single time. So they didn't spend even $1 on healthcare. And about 80% spent less than $425, and this is in 2002. So 80% of the population is spending almost nothing, or at least is spending an affordable amount that would be acceptable, I think, to charge out of pocket as a deductible. But a very small percentage of the population, maybe around 5%, spends enormous amounts on healthcare. So these are very catastrophic cases. So a per capita expenditure is not as meaningful as one would think. But it is interesting to note, if you were to compare per capita expenditures publicly, for instance, just to bust some myths here, the United States spends per capita about the same publicly that actually a little bit more than Canada spends publicly per person. And in fact, as a percentage of their GDP spends exactly the same we spend publicly. So if you take the total health expenditure together, they spend a large amount privately that's added on to that, and so their total health expenditure is quite a bit larger as a percentage of their GDP. But maybe I could sort of jump into something, too, related to that. When dealing with health expenditures as a percentage of GDP, that is somewhat problematic because of the fact that we're really... what we find is there's a correlation that societies that are wealthier tend to spend larger percentages of their economy on healthcare, which doesn't mean that, you know, we shouldn't look at healthcare necessarily as a cost. Actually, if you compare horse and buggy to modern automobiles, it'd be a bad thing if we spent more on horse and buggies and less on automobiles. It's not a bad thing we spend more of our economy on high technology. So it would be a good thing if we spent a higher proportion of our GDP as well on healthcare, if it was spent right under the right system with the right incentives. Yes.
And let me give you this one so we can record off this one.
Yes, go ahead.
Hi, since you've got lots of facts and figures, can you tell the audience what the corresponding waiting times in the United States are?
Well, that's very interesting. I can provide you only anecdotal evidence because there's no broad-based measurement in the United States similar to that produced by the Fraser Institute. In fact, there's usually only a case-by-case analysis of these sorts of things. But let me use access to an MRI machine, which in Canada, for instance, can take, depending on your jurisdiction, from 3 weeks to 9 weeks, in some cases 18 weeks to access an MRI machine. Depending on your condition, can take much longer. In the United States, it's a matter of administrative delay. How fast can we get you in? Depends on how fast can we fill out the paperwork, how fast can you drive here. You know, we're talking a matter of days. It's interesting. I have an anecdote. In my building where I live in Toronto, there's some friends that we've made who have immigrated here from Venezuela. And the young lady had some trouble, internal stomach problems. And she was in such severe pain she couldn't even walk. She had to be carried to the hospital. So she reports herself to a Canadian hospital. She finds that there's a delay for admission to the emergency room. 14 hours she waited. She finally gets in. She gets a diagnosis, which is that they don't know what's wrong with her. Then, and I'm not knocking doctors and their knowledge base here, but I think these are systemic problems. So then she decides, well, look, you know, isn't there some way to find out what's wrong with me? Well, yeah, we can get an MRI machine and we can do this diagnostic test, but it's going to take you 14 days before we can get you in to see a doctor that will perform this diagnostic service. Instead, they opt to drive to Buffalo the next day and obtain access to an MRI machine. So, again, our system is rationing access to these kinds of things that, in many cases, might not make the difference for someone, but there are a large number of cases in which it does make the difference.
I just wanted to thank you for your talk. It was really good, and I hope that it furthers debate in this country and brings us closer to a reasonable solution in the healthcare situation. I just had a concern. I hope you can address it for me. Now, let's imagine I was, you know, a really good doctor, and if I had my choice, I practice in the private system over the public system, and I think throughout the whole country, that would probably be more reflective of what would actually happen. Now, would that reduce the quality of care in the public system?
Well, that's a good question, and I think it's one that comes up in debate quite often. And there's a number of ways to address that. First of all, if we moved immediately to a system that allowed the parallel private option without addressing the government interference in the training of physicians, then we would have a problem. And let me explain why. The doctor shortage that we currently have in Canada is a direct result of government decisions. Governments fund medical education directly by subsidizing tuitions for medical education. What they have done is they've taken a concerted decision to reduce the funding for those training spaces so that we do actually produce fewer doctors graduating from university. And the reason they've done that is because of a report that was published in 1991 by a couple of academics, Morris Behrer and someone named Stoddard. And essentially what the report said was that everywhere you see a larger number of doctors practicing, you see higher healthcare expenditures. Well, to me, that's kind of an unusual finding that you would see, you know, people billing for medical services in an area and a larger number of them. That would obviously drive up costs, but it's getting the cart before the horse. It's not that doctors are inducing demand for their services, which is the conclusion they had drawn, but it's that doctors are following demand to an area, right? They're going where they can collect fees for their services. And so really artificially capping the physician supply has led to the shortage we have now. So that would have to be addressed in moving to a private system. I would expect to see better quality doctors in the private system, and I would expect that they would be paid more, and that's why they'd go there. But that doesn't mean that the quality of care in the public system would be worse than it is now. In fact, it would be better than it is now for a large number of reasons related to its competition for patients with the private sector, for instance, related to the fact that the private sector would produce advances in knowledge that the public system could benefit from. The private sector would produce a greater level of resource development in terms of the money that could be spent in the private sector would generate like new MRI machines would be put into place, new hospitals would be built, so the public sector could essentially contract those new services and goods that would not have existed without a private option. And so you would find that if the transition is managed properly, if doctors are required to spend part of their time in the public system while they make the transition to the private sector, and if governments take the reins off of the training of physicians in universities, then the physician supply will adjust over time. And as all other sectors of the economy, we would find basic rules of economics, and then supply and demand would adjust and then reach an equilibrium in the market.
Okay. Can I ask a follow-up to
this? Sure.
Which just means I want to ask another question.
Sure.
But are Canadians allowed to buy private health insurance if they want to drive to Buffalo and get an MRI?
This is interesting. The increased wait times in Canada, and in fact the media attention to that, has led a number of American insurance companies to enter our market and provide private insurance for people who want to go to the United States.
And that hasn't been restricted by the government?
To my knowledge, it hasn't been restricted. But there's certain, you know, there's economic barriers to the reason why most people won't do that. If they're paying high levels of taxes that they can't opt out of for the public system, they're already paying for access to something they think that they should get, or they're promised every day by politicians they have, then there's not much market demand for those kinds of private insurance products. So I think that's probably a barrier to their widespread use and expansion. I think ultimately what one would like to see is a public insurer operating like a Crown Corporation, perhaps, and funding itself through a system of premiums and deductibles on basic insurance principles, and then having that compete with the private sector in insurance, in which a large number of companies would compete for business on that level.
Next one. Do you have one there? So I have a slightly tangential question. It's not something that's measured, I guess, but I hope it matters, because I'm equally as interested in anecdotal statistics. I'm just curious about your friend that went to Buffalo and whether or not her access to the MRI machine actually resulted in a definitive diagnosis. It's just personal curiosity.
It did, in fact, in which they reported to the Canadian healthcare system in Ontario and were not moved up the queue. They were told they had to wait. Now, admittedly, they're not citizens of Canada. They're residents of Ontario for only a short period of time, so I'm unsure what the rules are in terms of accessing public services. But they were forced by circumstances to obtain care in the United States, which they obtained immediately. And in fact, they were told by their doctors in the U.S. that what was being any diagnosis they had received, any partial diagnosis, was completely wrong, and that some of the doctors, in spite of that, had already prescribed a regimen of care that they would pursue when there was time, and that that regimen of care would have been detrimental to her condition. And so, and thankfully, she obtained services that she needed on a timely basis. She had to pay for them, but she's more than willing to pay for them, in fact. She did note that in Venezuela they had that option, and they don't here.
Thank you so much for that.
You're welcome.
More questions?
Jim. I'm not sure if you're aware of the situation with the Sarnia Hospital. Apparently, it has been running a deficit for several years, and Smitherman recently threatened to close the hospital if they didn't shape up within, I believe that they've got 5 years to do so, and this is creating quite a furor in Sarnia. But I think this might be just another example of some of the problems with the healthcare.
You're right, Jim. It is another example, but it's important to note that it's inevitable that our healthcare system would produce these kinds of outcomes because of the incentives that are in the system. As long as public health expenditures are running out of control as they are, governments will be forced to do what they think is politically acceptable. Right now, they don't think it's politically acceptable to introduce a price for those healthcare services, and they don't think it's politically acceptable to allow people to exit the public monopoly. Instead, they think it costs them less politically to close hospitals or to force a hospital to lay off 10,000 nurses or a series of hospitals to lay off 10,000 nurses, as was threatened recently. And so these are the kinds of things that governments do, and I think they do that because it's less visible to people. And the reason it's less visible is, again, because of the distribution of illness in the population. Here's my political explanation. If only 5% of the public really has catastrophic medical needs, and only about 20% really spends any long-term period of time or any overnight period of time in the hospital, then that's a small percentage of the electorate, isn't it? So the people who are affected by these waiting times and by these real poor outcomes in healthcare are a small percentage of the voting population. And that's why it's easier for governments to ration and still be reelected than it would be to introduce a price for everybody that would be very unpopular, but would be the rational economic thing to do.
Hi. I have a friend there that used to live in Texas there, and her mother was a single mother with four kids, so all they could really afford was to go to a charity doctor there. And she mentioned that, you know, the charity clinic was open, was it 2 days a week there, and they, you know, thought that the doctor was on, you know, drugs there. So, but she seemed to think that, you know, it was great that, you know, she's able to get the free health care out of our system, and didn't like the sort of the U.S. style system. Like, how would you sort of respond to someone's concern like that?
Well, you know, as a libertarian, I don't believe that there's a necessary role for the state in healthcare. Prior to the state's intrusion in healthcare, the evidence seems to indicate the private sector was doing quite well. In fact, there were community cooperatives in terms that had developed as insurance mechanisms to help people access health insurance, one of which was started in Windsor, Ontario, which is my hometown. And it was very successful, and in fact, in the hearings that were held by the Douglas government in Saskatchewan, Windsor Medical, which was the name of that sort of cooperative insurance program, was mentioned as a very, very successful model upon which to build a public system. And the difference being that one was voluntary and one was coercive in terms of its funding, right? So, as a libertarian, I don't believe that there is a necessary role for the state, but as a practical political thinker, I recognize that that would be enormously scary for most people. And so instead, what I propose is something which is, I think, achievable politically, and which is also more rational economically, which is to minimize the role of the state in healthcare, and actually to make it consistent with the original goals of Medicare. The original goal of Medicare was to ensure that regardless of your ability to pay, you could access medically necessary services. That is a much different goal than making sure that everybody has equal access to medical services. And so if we were to minimize the role of the state in the sense of focusing its goal on achieving that social guarantee of charity, we could have a private sector charitable system that would accomplish that. But if we were to agree that, okay, it's politically acceptable to have a social guarantee of that, then we say, okay, the state will make sure that a targeted population of catastrophic medical cases, people who don't have the income or ability to pay for those things will be protected or have their expenses covered publicly by taxpayers. That's certainly a sustainable social approach compared to what we're currently doing, which is totally unsustainable. But that's not to argue that we actually need the state involved in healthcare. Oh, I would argue that we, in fact, could have a quite successful charitable system, and there could be tax incentives for that that could drive that as well. That's right. Yeah, most hospitals were opened by religious or philanthropic organizations, hence the name of hospitals like St. Joseph's and St. Mike's and so on.
It seems that the biggest argument for kind of private expansion into healthcare, or at least ending the public monopoly, isn't so much to do the same things that the public sector is doing in the private sector, but to kind of spur in more innovative ways of doing it than the public sector does. And right now, there seems to be kind of a mentality that there's a one best way to do things in healthcare, and that's known and understood. It could be kind of applied mechanically across the system. Whereas when you kind of look internationally, you see things done in very, very effective ways. I think one of the best examples is maybe in India, where they have an eye care center, where they're actually flying people from Britain with a family member there, return trip, to have the eye surgery done, and it's being done cheaper, quicker, and with better results than if they did in Britain. And then that's the kind of innovation that you can get. But there's the kind of the threat that even if Canada kind of moves towards more of a private system, the government will keep that level of regulation that it's not really able to operate outside kind of the bounds of where the public systems operate now. I know some of the Fraser Institute reports kind of touched on some of the kind of key ways that the government restricts the way healthcare can be done. What do you think some of the, I guess, greatest threats are to really having innovation happen if we move to a private healthcare system, given the set of rules? Like, what are the kind of key points where the government should loosen up on to allow more innovation to occur?
Sure. I do think a lot more innovation would occur if there were a market system, because the incentives would be in place to pursue innovation. Even within our current system, we see innovation in certain healthcare procedures. In Windsor, Ontario, as I mentioned, my hometown, there's a laser eye clinic there that is frequented by Americans on a regular basis. In fact, it's most of their clientele. And they provide this cutting-edge laser eye surgery that corrects your vision. And they can do things, they implant lenses in your eye and all kinds of really cutting-edge stuff. And the Americans come here because we have a cost advantage relative to what is provided in their system. That's essentially why they cross the border. But it's quickly being recognized that that clinic itself is producing better quality work as well. So eventually they'll be able to, you know, get a greater price for their work, but they'll still be able to attract clientele on the basis of quality. That's an example of innovation and what can occur if there are market incentives built into our system. But there are prohibitions. The Canada Health Act will financially penalize the provinces through the transfer system if they allow a parallel system of private payment and private delivery. The provinces themselves have legislation prohibiting it. So there's many areas of healthcare that could undergo innovation. They could be produced with a better cost-benefit ratio. They may not be less expensive than what we pay for now. They may, in fact, be more expensive, but you'll get more in return. And, you know, you may pay more for a Ferrari versus a Volkswagen, but you're driving a Ferrari. It makes a big difference. And so I think if our system were allowed to develop according to normal market incentives, then you would see a greater amount of innovation occurring in healthcare. And in fact, that would be looked at as a good thing, even if it generated higher costs, because those costs would then be looked at as economic value.
And going deeper than that, though, what's the way to prevent, I guess, the government from basically applying the rules that they have to the way to operate in the public system, just shifting that to the public sector or private sector, so that they're operating within the same bounds? I know there's some rules that physicians have to see patients for certain treatments, even if basically the treatment can be done by nurses perfectly effectively, but it ends up taking up a lot more physician time and slowing down treatment a lot. So it's not the way the rules are set up. How many of those exist across the board down the road?
Yeah, I'm not sure following you, but I think what you're talking about is the scope of practice. And there is legislation that regulates the health professions, doctors and nurses and other health professions, and basically outlines what they are legally allowed to do in their scope of practice. And what that does is it creates monopolies within health professions, so there's very little overlap of what occurs. So physicians are allowed to prescribe medicines, for instance, maybe end up becoming the gatekeepers for your access to medicine. And other people may be, other professionals may be capable of also prescribing, like pharmacists, for instance. In hospital, there's a large number of activities, as you mentioned, that nurses might be able to perform. In family clinics, a nurse practitioner may be able to perform many of the duties that a general practitioner or a family physician performs. These are all the kinds of things that would occur in a market, because the incentive would be to produce the greatest amount of care for the least cost. And if we have a system that, as we currently have, where all costs are guaranteed publicly and redistributed from people who aren't using the service, all of those incentives are distorted. And so that's when you end up with the kinds of problems that you're mentioning, a lack of innovation, a lack of cost efficiency, a poor cost-benefit outcome. Those are the kinds of things that occur when you don't have proper economic incentives.